my name is Clancy Immerslund, and I'm an alcoholic. I thought he was going to read the good part from that book, the preface. I'm very glad to be here tonight. I've been in Texas a lot. I've been here to many, many AA conventions and dinners and hospital openings and things, and I always look forward to coming here. I don't really have a deep memory of Texas because I was knocked out of me by the electric shock treatments in Big Spring. But I've been told I had a wonderful time in Texas. And I think this is a great conference. You know, everybody says, Houston is not a convention city. We can't get a convention going. I heard that two or three times from your worried committee. And as recently, 3 days ago, they said, what? I was talking to one of your dignitaries. In your experience, what's the ratio between pre-registrations and the people who show up? And I almost said, could I have my plane fare in front? But it's great. I want to welcome you all here, especially you people out in the half measures hallway. That's really unfair. You can't get in, but we don't care. We are going to have a drawing later, too, that I hope you'll stay for, these same tickets, so don't throw them away. First prize is a Jim Williams announcement tape. Second prize is two Jim Williams announcement tapes. He's just so down home, it just makes me feel warm when he talks. He's a wonderful man. I hate to say that, but I go to a lot of conventions. I don't know anyone who ever treated me better than he and his wife did at the Texas convention in Fort Worth a couple years ago. Because he is a very well-known speaker, and he has a lot of juice and a lot of followers, and people have a great deal of respect for him. And Eloise is a very pronounced personality and a leading figure of Al-Anon, and so traditionally those kind of people make terrible hosts and hostesses because they just want you to compromise with them all the time. And they were just great. They just let me alone, and anytime I wanted to do anything, they'd be right there and get the car and took me to one of the grubbiest all-time rotten barbecue slop shoots. And that's just what I love. And we had a good time, and that was a great weekend. I want to thank him for that. But he's crappy on announcements. I want to thank your committee for inviting me. I want to thank her. I wouldn't even mention Zola's name on a tape for burning me off at the airport. I had a difficult day yesterday. I only had to do my work, but I had to do his work. That boob sat in my office crying, and I got my shoes all wet, and I had them shine. And rushed to the airport and got here tired and down and cold and kind of lonely, and I got off the plane, and I looked around, they all looked back at me. So I took my little bags, and I just walked alone through the airport. And I said to myself, I guess they're probably busy down at the hotel. Fortunately, I ran into a guy from California named Bob, who was a good friend of mine, and he was being met by a guy named David from Madisonville. And I didn't say anything, but they noticed that I was kind of puckering up a lot. They said, you ever ride? And I said, no, I don't. And they gave me a ride over here, and I was very gracious. And when I got here, several people attacked me for not being there when Zola finally got there. Let me make my amends right now, Zola. I'm really sorry. This has been an excellent convention. I don't know that, I think I can safely say, from what I've heard, I've been in all the meetings, I don't recall a better convention I've ever been to. I mean, every speaker was excellent, and everyone had something to say, and they were all straightforward. I've heard Sandy a number of times, and last night he gave, I told him after the talk, he said, that was the best I ever heard him talk. Sandy's one of those speakers who couches thought-provoking items in humorous terms, and so when you get done, you think you've just taken a lot of sugar down, but there's a lot of medicine in there. That's why I never listen to any of his tapes. I'm afraid I'll start thinking about those things. And I just like to have my laugh and get out, you know. But he gave an excellent talk. Really a deep thought-provoking substances, because there's something in what he said that's very true for all of us. The I'm nothing syndrome is certainly a great syndrome that most of us are familiar with. At least every alcoholic I've ever known is familiar with. And this morning, Dottie gave an outstanding talk, and she was up and bright and cheery, as cheery as you can get at 9:30 in the morning. And she has had her ups and downs, and she's had a difficult way to go, as everybody has sometimes. And I think I'm glad to see her and feel her on the upswing, because I think it's going to get a lot better before it ever gets worse. And Elsa, who gave a great talk, she just always gives a great talk. You never hear a better Al-Anon talk. Well, not a talk, not a better talk without an accent. Then I went to AI. She's just a grand lady. She's a great example for everybody on the West Coast, I guess, and most of the rest of the country. Some of you heard the tape of Chuck's funeral memorial service. And I said something about memorial service, I was called upon to talk, and I said something that's really true. Whenever I needed inspiration, I would call Chuck. And I called him every week for over 20 years. I never missed a week that I could think of in over 20 years, sometimes more than once. But if I needed pragmatic knowledge, I called Elsa. Because she was living in the nuts and bolts, and that enabled Chuck to soar a little higher. She's a great lady. This afternoon, Jim gave a fine talk, and I remember Jim coming to AA and such a mess he was, and whiner. He doesn't tell you all the little nuances of his relationship with his sponsor. The time at the Saturday night meeting, he stood with his face literally turning blue, with his fist like this. I'm ready. Kill you, you son of a bitch! I'm gonna kill you! Then you go, sponsors at that time go into what is known as the Manolete mode. I know I have that bull dominated, I just hope he knows it. And I stared at him, I said, take your seat! How dare you talk to me that way! I want to wish you a lot of luck, honey. You should have seen him before he got better. And I think his charming bride gives I just love her Al-Anon talk. Because she talks about where it is. It's a funny thing. I don't suppose there could be two people more widely divergent in their background than Elsa, the drama queen of Hollywood High, and the honey of the honky-tonk. I watched them both when the other was talking. Nobody was identifying with anybody. Huh? You stayed in high school, you silly fool. But they're really so divergent that they're almost in a circle, that they're almost together on the other side. It's just, they both are saying exactly the same thing. And tomorrow morning we'll hear the Squire of Calistoga, who gives an excellent talk. He has many faults, but he thinks the way I do, so I forgive him everything. A lady, you may not recognize this illusion, because you have to be old to recognize it, but there's a lady in our New York office who's from San Francisco who feels that Mr. Gene and I are too effervescent in our approach to AA. And she told Jean a couple years ago, she said, "You know your problem, Jean? You and that Clancy are just like Penrod and Sam." Now, you don't know who Penrod and Sam are, but they're... And it's just as well, I'll tell you. They were just two perpetual immature kids who just were always in trouble. And the only beef that Gene and I have is which one is Penrod and which is Sam. Penrod was the leader, and we are vying. How long have you been sober now, Gene? I guess I'm Penrod. But I'm very glad to be here tonight, because this is really a remarkable demonstration. I've been thinking in the last few weeks. I've been talking about it once or twice. I want to talk about it once more, because it's such a remarkable thing. You know, the things we've heard about, and we'll hear about tomorrow, this thing called alcoholism, we sometimes have a tendency to think is caused by modern pressures or something that's brought about recently. But as far back as they have been able to trace fermented beverages, alcohol, and that's over 5,000 years, as far back as they've been able to trace fermented beverages, there has never been a time without a certain percentage of that population who respond to it unnaturally. There's always a percentage of people who respond to it unnaturally. Over the years, things have been tried. As Elsa mentioned this morning, she said up until when Chuck first started drinking, there wasn't any AA, and there was nothing to do for those kind of people. You just, because it looked as though they were doing it on purpose, I think the quotation she used. And I understand that feeling. And there's still people who think of it that way today, but not as many. But here we have, for 5,000 years or more, there have been people suffering from the disease you and I suffer from. And up until 1935, or sometime thereafter, once it began to be disseminated, just think, there was absolutely no place to go. We think there was a place to go, but there was no place to go. There were places like the Keeley Cure, where they just run them through. That was a modern innovation of the 1920s. Before that, you just locked them away, or sent them away, or put them in the insane asylum. That's all you did with them. And never talked about them. And in every generation, the Bible talks about these kind of people, and every piece of literature dealing with history talks about people who seem to have this terrible inability to control their drinking and apparently don't care. So, the net result is that you and I are extremely fortunate. When you stop and think about it, you and I today are living in 1% of recorded history where there is some place to go. 99% of recorded history, there's never been any place to go. And I mean no place. We are living in the 1% in which there's a place to go. There was one other brief time in recorded history that alcoholics could get sober. And that was in the early 1840s. Six guys got together in a bar in Baltimore and decided to stop drinking. And they got some friends to stop drinking. And without even being aware of what they were doing, they kind of set up a thing that was quite similar to Alcoholics Anonymous. And they called it the Washingtonians, after the founder of our country. And when you read about them, they're kind of interesting, because they did things the way we do them. They would go to other places where there are other members and talk and tell their story. And they would share with one another. It was all sharing. It wasn't education. It was sharing. And they grew remarkably. It was estimated by 1845 that there were about 200,000 sober alcoholics. Much faster growth than Alcoholics Anonymous. Tremendously much faster. And their experience, incidentally, we should say, has a great deal to do with several of our traditions, which some new people don't understand. They think traditions were just written when the book wasn't thrown in. The traditions were not written that way. The traditions were based on the Washingtonians and also a large number of people who died in AA doing it differently. These traditions didn't get accepted until 15 years after AA was founded. They weren't written until the late 1940s. But they fell into a trap. First of all, they knew nothing of anonymity. Why do we remain anonymous? The Washingtonians didn't. In fact, they got into a number of squabbles of who was getting the biggest newspaper articles where they spoke in New York and in Boston and Baltimore, and who was becoming the most famous. They got involved with other organizations. Some of them were into prohibition. Some of them were into religious movements. And they used the name Washingtonian. Any significant movement had the Washingtonian imprint from somebody or other. And the third great thing that we base the tradition on, about 1845 and thereabouts, they said, this is such a wonderful thing. This could change everything in the world. This would work for everybody. So they began a program of communicating their message to people with all kinds of problems. Gambling problems, sexual problems, laudanum, which was their version of heroin in those days, on and on, all kinds of problems. And they embraced them all and said, come to us, and we will help you. 3 years later, in 1848, there was not a sober member of the Washingtonians left. 3 years, from 200,000 to zip. Whatever members were left had marched off in the fit of pique to agitate for the prohibition movement. And the leaders, these so-called leaders who were vying for attention, were drunk. And they never could understand why. And the reasons are a little esoteric, because they placed personalities before principles, because they had no anonymity, they used their organization as a form of spiritual aggrandizement, because they forgot the basic subject of their thrust of their organization. And it's something we have to watch today. What is it that makes this movement and the early Washingtonian movement different from all other movements that have tried to help people like you and me? I'll tell you, as long as there's been fermented beverages, there have been people trying to help people like you and me to no avail. What is different about AA and the early Washingtonians that is not found anywhere else? And that's what we got to remember. You put aside all the gloss and all the, set aside all the conventions and all the big hoorah. The thing that makes Alcoholics Anonymous successful where nothing else has been, because the bottom line is always one alcoholic talking to another alcoholic. Not one alcoholic talking to a guy with a gambling problem, or a narcotic addict talking to someone with a sex problem. It is one alcoholic talking to another. That's what made the Washingtonians take off. That's what made this organization successful. And we must remember that. It's not that we're above or below any other problem. But the greatest problem you will ever have and I will ever have is to break down the wall. And I have kept a wall most of my life, and you have too. Yes, what you say may be true, but my case is different. And it's funny, except it killed people like you and me. And this is the only place where hopefully someone can say, no, it isn't different. Let me tell you why not. Not, oh, shape up. But I am like you, and if they will listen, you can get in sometime. But the net result of all this is you and I are very happy and very fortunate, very lucky. We're living in the best of all possible worlds. 50 years, a half a century of the only ongoing successful application of a treatment for this illness in the history of mankind. You might almost say that this problem is almost over with, except for one little thing. And this is funny, but it isn't funny. We have the answer to alcoholism in our hands. And still, today, 1985, over 95% of alcoholics die from alcoholism. And you can say, how can this be? There's an answer. Doesn't make a difference if there's an answer or not. The problem is that they still don't believe there's an answer. When I'm talking about they, I'm not talking about the doctors or the lawyers or the psychiatrists. I'm talking about people like you and me. And I get so frustrated. Almost every day in my job, I watch people die. And I don't mean die figuratively. I mean die and put into a basket and carried away. A week and a half, a couple weeks ago, I was in Omaha with some of you folks. That week, on Saturday afternoon and Sunday, there were 5 deaths within 100 yards of my front door of my office. 2 from natural causes and 3 murders of drunken people killing each other. And on and on and on. I see people die every day. And of all of those people I see dying, I can't recall ever meeting one who's been a long-term drinker who hasn't been to AA. They've all been to AA. Every long-term drinker today, just about in the world, has been to AA. Not in the world, but in our country. And AA has, even with all of this answer, has no effect when the wall is high enough and thick enough to not let that data in. Because the door to your recovery, that lock is unlocked from the inside. It cannot be unlocked from the outside. All we can do is stand outside and make sympathetic noises, and hopefully they'll peer out somewhere along the line. But if they don't choose to do it, they must certainly lock up in there. And I get so disturbed at these people. Now, if these people, and people I see in AA, and that guy that Gene sent out, he sat in my office yesterday morning, I really gave it to him good. I mean, I wasn't as upset as I appeared to be. I was trying to shake him out of an apathetic state, but I just get so upset with these people. How can you not get better? At least try it, for God's sakes. Don't just lay there and die with a whimper. Try it. And it just baffles me. And then I have to remember, I went to AA year after year after year after year after year. And at the end of 9 years in and out of AA, I was more convinced that I wasn't an alcoholic than I was the first time I went. In fact, when I was at, most of you know, when I was the resident sage of the Big Spring Nut House some years ago, where I'd been placed by a group of jealous lawyers, I really thought I was cute because I was in there as a psychopath, not as an alcoholic. And I was able to simulate being an alcoholic to get out. And I thought, boy, I fooled those idiots. And the funny thing is, just doing that made it unnecessary for me to drink after that. I never drank again. Until I ran out of Thorazine. When you run out of Thorazine, it has a tendency to make you edgy. But like the book says, despite all we can say, some of us will not be willing to get this message. When he wrote that book, he thought, certainly there might be only a few after it became well known. Still 19 out of 20 are still dying. And nothing has ever been anywhere near as successful as we are. If you were in Montreal, what a great surge that was. What a great surge to sit in that Olympic auditorium, full all the way around, all the levels of sober alcoholics, all of them up, all of them excited, all of them waiting for the meeting to start on Friday night. Some boobs over there were so excited they saw there was a stadium, they started to wave. And Christ, a goddamn wave went around. And I was so upset, I almost lost my place. Ah! Yeah. You think I'm going to let some pukes from Denmark do a better wave than I would? Ah. And stop and think. Never in the history of the world, and perhaps never again for all we know, will there ever be such a large group of sober alcoholics congregated in one place at one time. There may be, again, if they can find a stadium even larger to hold them, but that's about all. There is nothing else that works on a sustaining basis. And yet today, you and I will know people who say, AA is all right. But I've heard that therapy X is better. Or fringe religion Y. Or introspective understanding Z. Or if I could only realize what my parents have done to me. and on and on. And it just makes you crazy. Why can't you accept it? And then the answer always is, why couldn't I accept it? Why did I have to die in the garage to be brought back to life because the guy just heard the motor running? And I didn't come out and kicked open the door and I was dead in the car with my hose hooked up to the exhaust. And took me out and beat on my chest, breathed in my mouth, got me to the psych ward and examined me for 2 weeks. And I hadn't had a drink for some time. I had no idea. That's why it was one of the reasons I was such a suicidal depression. I was trying to hold that job. I was directing a grand opera at the university there, and I had one of my three jobs I was holding. And it just, the guys examined me and just determined I was a badly split personality, a schizophrenic, a dual personality, and they didn't see any prognosis for recovery. So I was committed to Big Spring for an indefinite period for the rest of my life. And I thought about that a number of times. I was back in El Paso a couple years ago, talking at a convention, and I got through a series of funny things. I have four kids. Four of my kids are at the University of New Mexico, two on the faculty and two are undergraduates. So I picked them up and I took them along down, and I took them to, they hadn't ever been back, and they were little kids when we lived there. And I was pointing out the city. I said, here's where we used to live. Remember that? Remember that? Vaguely. Here's where you went to church for the first time. Remember that? Vaguely. Here's where you went to school, Crockett School, you remember that? Yeah, I think so. Here's where they put Daddy away, remember that? And as we went by there, I had a terrible surge. I wanted to rush in there and find that psychiatrist. He must be old and feeble now. I should be able to move him around pretty good. Just take him by the shirt button and say, hey! You stinking quack! You shouldn't be allowed to practice medicine. You examined me and gave me tests and Rorschach tests and profile tests and multiphasic tests and tapped on me and examined me and talked to me, and your conclusion was that I was a dual personality. You goof. I didn't say this, but this was botanicizing. I just grabbed by the shirt button and said, you idiot! If I could have got my personalities down to two, I'd have made it. My problem has always been the committee that forms in my head. At the slightest trace of pressure, they start assembling.
Well, what do you think? I don't know.
I hear people in AA say,
maybe I need group therapy.
I never did. Just go for a ride alone in my car, boy. But the great rationale I had in Big Spring and before and after. If I were in there for drinking, that might indicate I was an alcoholic. I don't drink because I'm a drinker. I drink to ease the pressures that get me that way. And sometimes I drink too much, and then people think I have a drinking problem. They mean well, but they, unfortunately, the highway patrol doesn't have any balloon to blow up to see how lonely you feel. They can't take a drop of blood out of your ear to determine that you're feeling very different today and you don't think people like you. And there's no white line to walk to measure your feelings of inadequacy. All they can do is wait till you drink to overcome it and then say you've got a drinking problem. And when I don't drink for a long time, I become terribly depressed and try to kill myself. That's what I do. I get terribly depressed. I read literature, I do a lot of things, but nothing ever works. And I went to AA. I went to AA again and again because at first I thought it might help. After that, I realized it didn't help because it was for a different type of problem. It was for a drinking problem. But I went to AA, and I went there because in those years, the early 1950s, it was still relatively new to people, and they always helped drinkers. Why don't you go over there? And they thought you were doing me well. I'd do that to get the heat off from an employer or with a judge or something. I'd go to AA. And it always made me sad because AA has no application to real problems. It really doesn't. I wish it did, but it doesn't. I remember just before I committed suicide in El Paso. I was feeling so bad, and I was just coming apart, and I went into one of their stinking meetings down there, and I've been to meetings in all the major cities by that time. And I said, I don't know if you people understand this. I didn't stay for the meeting. I wasn't that desperate. With a bunch of these boobs and sitting around, I said, I don't know if you understand this, right? I think I'm going crazy. What can I do? One guy looked up and said, well, son, keep coming back. You get just the slightest hint that the intensity of your misery is not being conveyed completely. As it turned out later, that's the correct answer, but who would guess that? And so my life went on and on and on, and the worst years I ever had in my life came along. Oh, go ahead. We don't see you. But there better not be any non-blondes moving. I stood in the streets of Los Angeles outside of the same mission I run now, but standing out in front of it, dying, no front teeth, clothes gone, try to explain to people, it isn't the way it looks. I'm an award-winning writer. I directed a grand opera that got views all over the world. I'm well known. I was nominated to be Junior Chamber of Commerce Young Man of the Year some years ago. But no one stopped to listen. I just kept going by. Say it, I tell you my story.
Screw off, you crazy bastard.
And if a man would have put a lie detector in my arm and said, are you an alcoholic? I said, no, I'm not. And that needle wouldn't quiver a 64th of an inch. Because alcoholics are people whose problem is alcohol. My problem are feelings and intensities and emotions and sensitivities. And I've spent hours of my life in those days thinking, maybe I was born in the wrong century somehow. Maybe I was born in the wrong country. Maybe there's some genetic thing. But I don't seem to fit into my family. And yet people always tell me I got such ability. But everywhere I try to use it, people say that's wrong. Or I don't feel part of it. Someplace, there must have been someplace. One of the most touching lines I remember hearing. And I've had that feeling, you said that feeling a lot, long before I heard the line. When I heard it in the movie, I identified. In this movie, On the Waterfront, Marlon Brando's riding in the back seat. He's a dock worker. He's riding in the back seat with his brother, the gangster. And he'd been a fighter, and the gangster got him to throw a fight. And after that, he never was. He couldn't get any more fights. He said, you shouldn't have done that to me, Charlie. He said, you shouldn't have done that to your brother. I could have been a contender. Not a champion. I could have been a contender. That's what the feeling I had all my life. If I could just find where it was, I could be a contender. I could be something. And I needed to be something very much because I wasn't, I didn't know it at the time, but when you need to be something that much, it usually is you don't have much on the inside. And since you don't have much on the inside, you got to have more and more on the outside if you possibly can. And nothing is ever enough. And that's why it's kind of surprising this week, Wednesday night at my home group, the same wife I didn't see for a number of years came down the aisle with my birthday cake with 27 candles on it, and my people I sponsor were there and some friends were there, and it was a touching moment. It's the first year in over 20 years my sponsor hasn't given me my cake. And but when we took our group picture, I left an empty chair so you'd know where to sit next time. And I suppose it's some kind of a miracle that I've, from that moment, standing in the street knowing all about AA, even at that time, I could quote the book better than the people who 12-stepped me. It wasn't a matter of lack of knowledge. And now probably my major aura, in addition to being eccentric and weird, is that I'm known in my area as a right-wing fascist AA pig. And I have no tolerance for people who can't accept it. And I want to say to you new people, you better get it the way we did in the old days. I wanted tonight, just for a couple of minutes, I was thinking something that Van Noy was saying today and Jim was saying today. This may be the only two ideas I ever got from either one of them ever, and I want to cherish them. If you'll pardon me for smoking. I know that in this day and age, it's wise not to smoke. And sometimes people today ask me at my table tonight, why do I continue smoking? And the answer is very simple. Someday, I believe, they will find a market for phlegm and I'll be rich. I'm a World War II veteran. But they were talking about how it is when you are sober a while, when you've worked the steps, and you get feelings of desperation. And that happens to almost anybody who's been sober more than 20 minutes. Sooner or later, that will happen. We sometimes leave the impression from the podium that if you're sober, you should feel wonderful all the time. And that is absolutely a piece of misinformation that kills people. And also, there's a new group in AA. There's always new people, and they're having a difficult time. And I tell you, to the best of my knowledge, if you're new tonight, I look over my life in those years that I was struggling, and apart from all of the steps in AA, I'll bet you that for people like me, and perhaps like some of you, the first three steps of AA have killed more people than any therapy I've ever known, because they are really goofy. When you have real problems, they are goofy answers. And you just, what do they say? I drink too much and therefore I'm all screwed up. And secondly, I'm going to ask God to get me over being crazy. I'm not crazy! I don't mind saying I'm an alcoholic. I don't think I'm an alcoholic. But I don't mind, I don't want to say I'm crazy because I think I'm crazy. No, what's this? Going to turn your problems over to Jesus. Yeah. That's great. That's beautiful. You can dance to that. You know, play the old rugged cross, we'll waltz. Yeah. But it has no application in the real world. And when I came to AA and they started laying those steps on me this time, I didn't want to hear them because they have no opinion. I sat in discussion meetings in the 6300 Club and I told them, AA is a nice place. I didn't say quite that clearly. You have me front teeth. Hey, it's a nice place. But it has no application to people who are intelligent. You can laugh. You have no idea what that's like. And my first sponsor, who was rather strong and strong on me. He didn't understand sponsorship as I had understood sponsorship. Sponsorship are people who put up with your crap and love you. And you call them drunk and they come over in the middle of the night and sit with you and get you through it. If you need a few bucks, they give you a few bucks. And this fool didn't know any of those things. He said he'd say things like, kid, call me anytime you want to, day or night. But late at night, it better be important. Call me anytime you want it. Up until the time you take a drink. Then don't bother calling. Because all you're going to hear from me is a click and a dial tone. Jesus. If I'm not going to drink, what do I need to call him for? And I've said this 100 times. I always like to hear it, though. I was living it. I told him, I have no place to live. I'm cold and hungry. I'm an intelligent man. I have no place to stay. Where do I stay? Down the end of the parking lot, there's an old Merc. Somebody left here about 6 months ago. Sleeping that. Okay, I thought it was a test. So I went down there and slept there that night, and I came back and said, okay, I slept there. It's good. Make yourself at home. I was in that damn car most of 7 months. One time after I took my fourth step out, a newcomer in the front seat. He never made it. Something about the wheel. But I said to him, I said, Bob, I'm not an animal. I'm used to living well. I worked at the largest advertising agency in the South, Tracy Locke in Dallas, and they thought I was brilliant. And I wrote the Elsie Nomarez. I've done so much, Bob. I'm living like an animal. I'm hungry and cold. I'm living in a abandoned car, Bob. What will I do?
Get a job.
I said, look how terrible I look.
Get a terrible job.
What kind of an answer is that, might I ask? But what I want to say is that I went to meetings every day and every night, mainly because I didn't want to stay in the parking lot. Might as well go in the club. They had donuts there and cake. By the time of my first birthday, I could not eat cake anymore. You just thought it was like to eat lovely lemon meringue cake.
Dream about boiled potatoes. Oh.
But
I remember after one of my harangues at the Friday night coffee cup discussion meetings, which was one of the truly assemblages of eccentrics in the entire Western Hemisphere. Just people had yellow hair on one side and blue on the other and wore funny things. And this was before that became popular. And I was giving my version on why the first step didn't apply to me. He said, because I am not really an alcoholic, because the first step doesn't really apply to me, and I have many problems that are not due to alcohol, which makes me a non-alcoholic. And he and the manager of the club, an old man named John Sullivan, who used to play bad cop and good cop on me till my eyes went around like two BBs in a saucer, just... I remember one of those two old fools saying to me, we sat down and had a cup of coffee. He said, you know something, kid? You really are full of crap. I said, yeah? I'm used to jealousy. And over a period of a day or maybe 2 days, they pointed out to me strongly something I want to convey to you. But it boiled down to this sentence. He said, I heard you talking about the steps this morning. He said, why don't you talk about something you know something about? You don't even quote them right. You give them nonsense. Why don't you just take the black parts on the page and leave the white parts to people who know something? I said, what does that mean? I explained. And I remember the line he used. He said, kid, why don't you read the first step? It really isn't hard at all. It doesn't ask you to admit you're a terrible alcoholic. It doesn't ask you to admit your problem was alcohol. It doesn't ask you to do any of these things. It's really quite simple. It says, we admitted we were powerless over alcohol. Have you had problems with alcohol on an ongoing basis? I said, yes. But it wasn't my fault. He said, the nice part about that is, you don't have to admit it's your fault. Blame them. All you have to do is admit you had a problem with drinking. That's all it says in the first phrase of the first step. And then he says, you're a big hotshot writer. I think you understand the language. That is followed not by a comma, but by a dash. And a dash in the English language means end of thought, beginning of new thought. The second thought in the first step says that our lives had become unmanageable. Was your life unmanageable when you weren't drinking? I said, yeah, but it wasn't my fault. He said, you don't have to say it was your fault. Blame them. But all you got to admit is this. It was crappy drinking, and it was crappy sober. Is that right? Yes, that's right. Congratulations, you have just worked the first step of alcoholism. And that's all it says. Anything beyond that is interpretation and extrapolation. For those who are new, as years go by, you may discover reinforcements of why that is. You may understand that alcohol has a special effect on your body that alters your perception of reality that it doesn't do for most people. You may discover that the adjunct to that is that alcohol can resolve conflict, that your ability to cope with conflict in reality will diminish. And you can discover, I can give you a 10-hour talk on that. But it all boils down to this. The first step, it makes me want to throw up when I hear people say, I just couldn't accept the first step. Do they read so much into it? You don't have to read anything into it. Drinking was bad, and sobriety was bad. That's all. And if either one of those things are not present, you wouldn't be here. If just drinking was bad, you'd quit. If just sobriety was bad, you'd drink. If they both go to hell, you're screwed. And nobody ever comes here when anything is working, hardly, you know. As I've said many times, I am still listening for that first speaker who will say, and then one morning I got up, put on my furry slippers, and I walked through the French door into the garden, and I thought to myself, I think I'll join AA. We all come here under the lash, one way or another, one lash or another. Now just start with that premise if you're new. You can't drink, and sobriety is untenable. That's all there is to it. You don't have to understand how it can change. You don't have to understand anything. All you just say, that's the way it is. Now, get into the second step. I'm going to synthesize their 3 months of admonitions in about 10 minutes here. You'll be glad to know. They've only got a 3-hour tape. I'm so sick of finishing my talk while the band is playing and the people are dancing. The one I love belongs to... Is there somebody squealing down there? Are you nervous again, Daddy? Now, the second step gets spooky, though. There's no logical way about that. Tend to believe God's going to restore me to sanity. And I had several conversations with them about that, and I had to explain to them. I do not accept the concept of God. Sorry. There may be people in AA who do, but I knew about God when I was a little boy. I know more about God. I can quote the Bible. I can sing religious songs and play them on the piano while I sing. And I know that I can't accept God. Other people come to me and say, I've been searching for God for 30 years. I never searched for God 10 seconds. I know where God is. He slowly circles the Our Savior's Lutheran Church in Eau Claire, Wisconsin. And he gives it to sinners. And he gives it to Catholics. And that's all right with me until you become one or the other. And as my kindly sponsor pointed out to me, he said, can't you believe in anything? I'll tell you yourself. I said, no, I cannot. You see, I'm an intellectual. In fact, the only closest I ever came to God for 20 years at one time in Dallas, another guy and I, we were terminally cute, and we almost got away with it, but we got caught at the last minute. We were going to put in a dial of prayer for atheists. We had the number set and everything. We had it set up, so you dial this number, and nobody ever answered. But he said, well, you think I'm doing better than you are? I said, I guess you are, goddammit. But it's not my fault. He says, congratulations. I'm your new higher power. And you want to know something funny? I accepted him as my new higher power. And a lot of people, I used to talk about it at meetings. They said, you can't have a human being as your higher power. That's ridiculous. Human beings are weak and fallible. You can't. But I want to tell you something if you're new today and having a little difficulty with finding a higher power. I would suggest to you that you accept a higher power that you can believe in. From where you are, not from where they are, where you are. Because an awful lot of people die around here because they get up and give wonderful talks about gods, they understand them, that they don't believe in. And at 2 o'clock in the morning, you got to turn to what they believe, and if you've been shucking them, you're dead. You better believe in whatever you can believe in. And I accepted this human being as my higher power. I didn't think he was higher power, but I invested simulated respect. And he became my higher power. I did things to please that old son of a bitch I would never do for anybody else, just to get him off my case. You know, just he would tell me to do this. But I'd do them. And if I didn't, Sullivan would snitch. It just, when you're in the club 18 hours a day, you have a high profile. But then what are you going to use this higher power for? As you point out, the step doesn't say God. It says a power greater than yourself. Don't read God into the second step. Read it. It may be God if that's what you want to believe in. But you got to come to believe in something that you can believe in. And what's he going to do? Restore me to sanity. Now there is a cute one. What is sanity? You can read 20 books on the brain and you will get 20 different definitions of sanity. What is sanity? Sanity is a very... Didn't mean to make you nervous, Jim.
Take off your coat. Sanity, Jesus Christ.
Sanity has many different things. But oddly enough, insanity is relatively easily defined. Sanity cannot be defined, but insanity can. Psychosis. Psychosis is the bottom line, highly overly simplified. When the brain, under sufficient pressure of ongoing, intense, neurotic conflict, can find no release, it will alter the perception of reality in order to reduce conflict. It's a self-preservation thing. And when you become psychotic, you don't just become non-psychotic again later. Psychosis is about, you nearly always did. We talk today about how psychotic and I was and I was. Once you become truly psychotic, the chances of you getting back are about 1 in 1 billion. Because that is a permanent condition. In some people, it's just a rifle psychosis. In some people, it's a 360-degree psychosis. You see, also, that's 360 degrees. Half of that is 180. You don't often get a chance to tell an Alan on anything, but... Don't tell Charlotte I said that to you. Going to restore me to sanity when I'm psychotic? What is psychosis? Psychosis is a distorted perception of reality. And over a period of time, as I worked with my sponsor, it became clear to me something else as I learned, this unusual reaction of alcohol in my body. What does alcohol do in the body of an alcoholic that it doesn't do in normal bodies? The number one thing that makes it lethal, it has the power to almost instantly alter my perception of reality. That's what makes alcohol deadly to me. It isn't what it does to me. I can beat that anytime. It's what it does for me. It takes a conflict almost... The symptoms of a sober alcoholic are almost exactly the same as that of an intense or acute neurotic. Obsessive behavior, extreme overreaction, intermittent explosions of emotions, deep introversions... Now, alcoholics almost never become psychotic. The cases of alcoholics becoming truly psychotic are almost non-existent. Why? Because when it gets bad enough, long enough, they drink alcohol. So he makes you think, why don't all these neurotics drink alcohol who feel as bad as you and I do? And that's the funny part. They do, but it doesn't resolve the conflict. That's why they don't drink it. I drink it, and I never knew that it didn't do that for anybody, everybody, but it does it only for 6 or 7% of people who drink, apparently. So, I have the power, and you have the power, unknowingly, that I can, in a socially acceptable manner, induce temporary psychosis. and the boom. I'll call up that goddamn household finance. The alcoholic's lifetime friend. Sure you don't want to consolidate one more time?
That's a good idea.
So maybe what that step means is quite simple. Maybe I have to come to believe that something here that I can believe in will make it unnecessary for me to induce psychosis. Maybe restoring me to sanity means just what it says, living in unsustained reality. Now, in that step also, you don't have to understand how it's going to happen. There's nothing to debate there. All you got to do is try to come to believe somehow, your sponsor, a friend, some concept, anything, will somehow in a way that you can't even foresee at this time make it unnecessary for you to have to drink to stand it. That's all. So you got two things. Can't drink, can't stay sober. That doesn't make it better, just it tells me where I am. Now they ask me to come to believe in something, and it may be a strange something because many people when they come here are just out of belief. That's one of the hallmarks of coming here, that you're out of faith. They insist you have faith. You may not be able to have faith in a childhood God. Have faith in something. If you have to grab, just grab a man that you can believe in and say, I trust you. And that's your higher power if you can talk to him. Well, restore me to living in reality. That's all. No big deal for those two steps. They're not spooky or magic. They're quite simple. Can't drink, can't stay sober. Somehow here I got to act as though I believe that there's some way to get over it. Although I can't see it and I don't see any way it can happen. Third, and the last of these trilogy of misunderstood steps that kills people. They want me to turn it over to God. Boy, that spoils it. There's no way around that. In Los Angeles, many years ago, I remember going to a meeting and saying, I got a bunch of hot checks out. If I don't cover my money, they're going to garnish my wages. I'll lose my job. What'll I do? This old timer said, son, turn those checks over to your higher power tonight. And I did. And Monday, the higher power turned over to Sheriff Peter Pitchett. That don't get it. I had to write off the third step. One of the reasons I wrote it off is because of Chuck C., who used to come to the 6300 Club at Easter and Christmas and stride in his gray suit and his handsomeness and his big Lincoln out there and his coterie of followers. Oh, it's Chuck! It's Chuck! Yay! I'd sit in a meeting and they said, now our speaker today, we're very proud to have Chuck C. He'd get up, everybody'd cheer. I'd get up and leave. I don't know if the meeting continued or not. They may have stopped it when they saw my disapproval. And God, Chuck had an aura of spirituality. Oh, if you want to hear about spirituality, talk to Chuck C. You talk to Chuck C, you silly son of a bitch. I'm trying to get a job. When I was about 6 months sober, through a series of bad breaks and misunderstandings, I had been fired on this job I had held for 2 days as a dishwasher. There's something undermining about when you can't hold a job for 2 days as a dishwasher when you're a trained intellectual. I could do the dishes, but I was cursed with perception. And as far as I could determine, these illegal immigrant Mexicans were bringing in more dishes than that restaurant was using. Which led me to deduce they were probably getting them from other restaurants to get me fired so they could get another one of their goddamn wetbacks in there. So I just did part of the dishes and why'd you take those back to your friends up the street, amigo? Well, unfortunately, I'd miscounted. That was all. And they fired me, and I tried to explain to them. I'm a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm trying to build a new life. I'm 6 months sober. I don't give a shit about that. You don't wash any dishes. Get out of here. I said, you'll pay for this someday. Now, you can laugh at that, but 14 years later, that restaurant went belly up. It is now some kind of a Bangkok restaurant. And I go by there and I give them the old double. So don't screw with me unless you got your future 14 years from now set up. Anyway. Well, when you lose your job as a dishwasher, I decided to drown myself. I can't go any further than I walked. I didn't know quite how to get to the ocean from where I was on Sunset, so I walked back to La Cienega, which is way out of the way, but I knew the route. And over to Wilshire and turned right and walked and walked. I knew the ocean was out there somewhere. And I don't know if you've ever done this, but feel very depressed. And if you're a dramatic person like I am, you also can see yourself kind of like a Hamlet trudging the lonely battlements at Elsinore. And you know, as people, as they go by, saying, what a terrible load that man must carry. We'll never know. And what they're really saying is, see that silly son of a bitch? And I walked. I walked. And I walked. And I walked. And I walked past Santa Monica or across the Wilshire. And I walked and walked. I couldn't find the ocean. It loses a little something of the old Frederick March when you can't find the ocean. So I stopped in the gas station. I said, where's the ocean? He said, he's just in Western Beverly Hills. He said, you got to go out past the Veterans Hospital. And then it's about 5 miles past that. I thought, well, shit. I don't mind dying, but I'm not going to do a walk-a-thon. Maybe we can dance all night and win a prize. So I called up my sponsor. I'd walked into his fare zone. I wouldn't want to blow 20 cents on the call. And I called him. And he said, hello? I said, Bob? He said, Clancy, why aren't you waiting? He had set up the job for me. He and a guy named Mike Ross. And I thought, I got to just once use all my creative powers. I'm just once going to get through to this guy and let him know I'll weave a tapestry of words that'll make this old sullen puke shape get to me. I said, Bob, before you say anything, let me tell you something, Bob. You know, I've lost my children. I'll never see them again. That's all right, Bob. That's part of the territory when you're like me. And my parents have ripped me off. I'm an only child. It wasn't until this morning I realized what a tragedy that was. That isn't the problem. The problem is that I don't mind. I like living in that car. That's all right. But in AA, everybody else seems to get along. I do not fit in AA, Bob. There's something different about me. I sit at a table. The guy sitting there will get up and go to another table. It's like Hal Marley right tonight. I said, it's just, you know, there's something, they sense something different about me. And they won't call on me at participation meetings, Bob. I try to make small talk and people turn their back on me. I'm alone in a strange world I didn't make and I don't understand, Bob. And it suddenly struck me, this is true. Jesus. My saddest story is one of my story of my life. And I burst into tears. Jesus Christ, Bob. What am I going to do?
Why don't you write your goddamn inventory the way I told you?
And that caught my attention. I almost shrieked, why don't you? I forget what I was going to ask him, but it was fun to watch him try it, the old fool. I said, Bob, in my judgment, that's the last thing in the world I need. God, if I could think about all those opportunities I've missed and all these chances and all these things, Bob, in my judgment, that'll kill me.
And your judgment? Who cares about your judgment? You live in an abandoned car, for Christ's sake.
He says,
If I wanted your judgment, I'd go down and put my head in the back window and ask you for it. I'm living up on Musk Kingdom Avenue in a $500,000 house. Who cares how it looks to you? And I tried to explain to him, but Bob, I've spent thousands of dollars in psychoanalysis. I already know the causative factors. And he said, I want to hear that. You gotta turn off your stinking judgment. Like I said to you, Jim, only much nicer. You got any proof? And that, he made me so upset, I want to let that out of it. And I had a shot of adrenaline in my system. I shot, fortunately I turned left, I'd have made that ocean in 3 bounds, boy. And I got back to the system, I said, son, you're the bummer. Oh, my God, you're the bummer. And I wrote that inventory, and when I got all done, nothing changed. I went to sleep that night in the backseat of an abandoned car. Half a day hungrier than I had been before I took this marvelous therapy. The only good feeling I had, the best I could identify, I'd proved that old fool writing an inventory didn't help. And that cheered me up. And about a week later, I was suicidal again, and I read it to him. I swore, because I was so upset, and I wrote this thing, that I put in things in which I wasn't the hero. Oh, Christ. And he took me for a ride along the ocean to Oxnard, and I read this to him, and I thought, he's gonna throw me out of his car. I go that near Oxnard, and I looked over, and he's going, I made the old man snap. But I'll tell you, I've made that trip maybe 250 times since then on the left side of the car. That Boob and Arlie and a number of people in this room have ridden on the right side. And I'm a much better sponsor than my sponsor was. I always turn my head when I yawn. In fact, most inventories, people before they start reading them say, there's a couple things I want to explain about this. They don't know. If you've got something new in there I haven't heard, I'll give you $10. I'd love to hear something new, something really exotic. Instead of the same old disintegration of the human spirit, whether it's at the level of $250,000 a year or a guy on Skinner, it's the same story with different details. In fact, after a while, you can hear the thrust of the story as you start. Then it's just a long trip. Right, you can tell when people left something out. He said, didn't you leave something out of there? You've been talking to that bitch? A fourth and fifth step in retrospect is so simple. It's just when you're doing it, you want to kill yourself. But I took my inventory. And I thought about this sometime later. I thought, isn't that funny? That day that I walked left out of the post, out of that telephone box, that day I took the third step of Alcoholics Anonymous. I turned my will and my life over to the care of the power greater than myself in which I believed. And I didn't agree with them, and I hated it. And ever since then, whenever I'm in stress, if I have someone to talk to, I talk to them. If I have a knowledge of what should be done, it seems to me the ongoing problem for all of us is that we must remember, again and again, I must resurrender and resurrender and resurrender. It is not making mistakes that gets people drunk. It is the defense of the mistakes that makes people drunk. That is why I can forgive almost anybody anything if they are back on the path. People that I can't bear to look at when they're off the path. Because all you got to have to do is, all of us better hope there's no ex post facto justice. I'll tell you. As I've said many times, a lot of young people today think they're the first ones who ever cried out for justice. I was crying out for justice in 1946. Stood on the barricades of the cutting edge of the liberal movement. Justice! We demand justice for all mankind! And like young people today, I also said, if it's not enough to go around, I'll take mine and screw them. As you get older and wiser in this world, you don't hardly ever cry out for justice anymore. The cry becomes, mercy, mercy, forgiveness, let bygones be bygones. not my fault.
So I got to extend that a little bit. But the net result is this. Somehow or another, you must submerge your judgment in moments of crisis. Because when I am in crisis, my perceptions get distorted. And the same things look different. And my mind feeds me different answers. And I have to have a source outside of myself that I trust enough to allow them to superimpose clear perceptions over my distorted perceptions. And they will look exactly wrong. But I must operate on the... I must have faith whether I have faith or not. As my old sponsor used to say to me, you've got to be sincere whether you mean it or not. And the nice thing about AA is nobody cares why you do it. If you take the action, it gets better. So, if you're new tonight, or if you're, let me say first to the new people, if you are new tonight, let me say this. Not much to debate. You obviously can't drink or you can't control it on a continuing basis or else you wouldn't be here. It doesn't mean every time you take a sip your hair grows long and you leap onto passing nuns. What it means is I'm having trouble drinking. And you're also having trouble sober. And you will have somehow come to believe, find somebody or something that you will pretend to be interested in enough to come to believe that maybe there's a way that you can't see yet to live in reality. And then when the crunch comes, ask them what to do. That's all it is. If you can do that, you will be able to take a fourth step. Unless you do that, a fourth step will be a nonsensical series of marginal things. And you'll be able to take a fifth step, and you'll be able to ask God to remove defects you never knew you had. That's one of the great things about a good fifth step. You find a different perception on the same things. And you can make amends to people that you'd swear you'd never make amends to. My father, I hadn't talked to him for years. He was so disappointed in me. And his sadness about me made me feel guilty, so guilty toward him I wanted to kill him. And my sponsor made me make an amend to him. I said, he deserted my mother and I, and I got a list of reasons this long. He said, I don't care. You hurt him bad. Send him a letter. He wanted good things for you. So I sent him an amends letter. I wasn't very good. I sent him another one later. And he wrote back, and he sent me an amends letter. And for the last 20 years, my father and I have just been as close as can be. And one of the reasons, I'm not putting down any organization, but the organization that they find out why you should hate your parents is wrong. Because the function of AA is now, and then was then, and let's live today. My father came out and lived with us, and I sent him to UCLA, and he had a shunt put in his head, and went back to Eau Claire, Wisconsin. He did very well. Then he got sick again, and some local doctor was going to fix the shunt and wound up paralyzing him from head to toe. And he lay in a bed for a year, couldn't move. And I went there a lot. But he and I were very close. He would laugh with his eyes when I'd tell him jokes, although he couldn't move his body. It was an ironic thing. Within a period of a month of that, after I was sober 2 years, my sponsor died. And he, because he had stopped doing the things... He told me to do things, I did them, he didn't, he got drunk and died, and I stayed sober. There's a moral there somewhere. And some years later, I went to this man that I had detested because he was getting along so well, and I went to his shop one day, and I said, Chuck, I'd like to have you be my sponsor. And he said, gee, that's surprising. I thought you came down here to offer to be mine. Well, I realized I'd made another horrible mistake. I've never had any luck. But by that time I'd been very active, and what I was looking for was a man ahead of me who was more active than I was, who exuded what I wanted. And I'll never have what he had. But by God, he was out there and he was doing it, and people talk about his spirituality. His spirituality was getting out of his chair and going to do it. And taking care of the things, as Elsa talked about. And I know it must be tough for the people at home to get up and go all the time. But I know this, when I stayed home with my family, they had to commit me. So there's something to be said for that. within a period of a month this fall, this winter. My sponsor died and my father died. And I talked to him each the day before they died. I called Chuck up on the Thursday morning, and he sounded so bad. And he couldn't talk straight. I thought, what the hell now? Because I'd been down to see him many times in the hospital, his home. He was so unhappy with his illness, because he was such a vital man. And that morning I thought, what is it? And I found out later, he'd had a little stroke that morning. And he was still picking up the phone, talking like this, because he wanted to talk to people who needed help. And the next morning, Bill called and said he'd passed away. And I had such a great feeling, because the day before I said, I wish God would take him out of here. He deserves better than this. And about 3 weeks later, I sat by my dad's bedside, I wish God would take him out of this. Next morning, he went to sleep and died. And you think that'd be a terribly sad thing, that your sponsor and your close father die? And yet I had a great, it gave me a renewed belief in the grace of God as I've come to know it in Alcoholics Anonymous. And that's why I would say one more thing to the old timers. People have been sober a while, they get desperate, and they search frantically, which of the last three steps am I not working? What should I do more of? I think you may have to do what I have to do from time to time. You must go right down to the bedrock. You must decide where you are and be willing to sacrifice anything to get away from it. Material things, situations, a job you can't stand, whatever it is. Because you just go back to this. And I've used this for a trampoline in AA 200 times over the years. When all else fails, when my prayers don't seem to be answered, when people are acting weird, when the job is going to hell, when it's really tough, I just have to get down on the knees by my bed and start all over again. Well, let's see, where am I? I can't drink. And reality is untenable. That's the nature of where I am. Somewhere, I have to regain my belief that it will get all right, enable me to live in reality. And then I must turn over my actions to what I believe in, even though it doesn't have money, property, or prestige, or juice connected with it. And that trampoline always gets me back to basics. It's a hard thing. And nobody wants to do it, because when you got a position to maintain, when you're an old-timer, when you got a lot of power and a lot of juice, and I'm going to get that new car no matter what it takes. I don't care. We're going to do this, do that, something. And the pressures and the conflicts nearly always emanate from an image I'm trying to live up to. And it boils down to this. When you're new, when you're old, and all the time in between, when you reach out and you got the wrong end of the stick again, and there's no way out. Just remember this, it's easy. You and I can't drink, and doing the best we know how, you and I can't stay sober. If sobriety is untenable, it usually means that I'm attempting to apply old remedies that didn't work before, but now I think I can get away with. Secondly, as much as I hate to admit it, I must regain the faith that it can be all right, even though I don't see a way out at the moment. And I must be willing to do whatever to simplify my life down to the level where that will happen. And thirdly, I must sit in those chairs and listen to those people and sit on the phone and listen to people whine and do those things and find someone to talk to and say, I'm really not doing as well as I look. Here's my problem. What could I do? And when they tell me to do it, even though it seems stupid. And then it gets better again. These three steps keep a lot of people away because they look esoteric. They are simple to get you in, and they are a trampoline to keep you in. That's why Alcoholics Anonymous is such a dear thing. That's why people like you and me have to spend the rest of our life. There's 95 people out there for every one of us, and they sincerely believe that their case is different. If you will talk to them and tell them how your case was different, they will have a chance. They may die, but they will have a chance. Our job is to see that they get it. Then we can stand as we stand at these podiums, say that magic phrase they say in Texas, my name is Clancy Innocent. Through the grace of God and the actions of Alcoholics Anonymous, it has not been necessary for me to drink or take any mind-affecting or altering drugs since
October 31st, 1958, or whatever the date is. And for this, I am truly grateful. Thank you.